On your journey through life, you are the hero. There are times, however, when it is beneficial to have an advisor to guide you along your path. Welcome to the Smart Money Simplified Podcast with Brent Mikosh, certified financial planner, certified investment management analyst, and co-founder of MP Advisors LLC. In this podcast, Brent discusses some of the most important and interesting topics of the day as they relate to finance, the economy, and beyond. Now, on to the show.
Hello, and welcome to Smart Money Simplified with Brent Mikosh. Brent, how are you?
Eric, I'm doing absolutely fantastic. I got back from my 10-year anniversary trip last week, and I was in Northern California. It was great.
Congratulations.
Great to be back here in Phoenix.
Oh, that's fantastic. Congratulations. I'm so glad that you had a chance to get away, and I'm glad you're back safe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. We are all moved. We sold a house and moved into another house, and boy, I am old, and I got too much stuff. So those two things are on my list. I got to figure out how to fix one of them at least.
All right.
I know you got a guest today in studio. Who'd you bring in?
I do. I'm really, really excited about this one. I've actually, for clients that are listening in, when I talked to you about the steel guy, when I've shared some of his comments to me, this is who I'm talking about. I'm talking about Jeremy Flack. He's the founder and CEO of Flack Global Metals, and he's been in this business since the 1990s. And it's just such, whenever I have conversations with Jeremy, it's such an optimistic conversation about what's happening in the world economy. It's really easy to turn on the news and you see Russia, Ukraine, you see inflation, you see supply chain and all these issues. And one of the things, particularly around the economy, that is really, really fundamental, it's steel. I mean, steel is absolutely the base of almost every country's economic might. And Jeremy's in it. You know, he's in there with all the suppliers and all the players in that space. And he's got a lot of great insight to what's happening in the economy for sure. So I'm thrilled to have him here. Jeremy, thank you for coming in.
Well, Brent, thank you for having me. It's an honor in a way for somebody to even care about the steel industry. You know, we've been bumping along in this country for a couple hundred years in the steel business. And every now and then we pop up and we become interesting. So it's nice to see you realize what an integral part of things that we are.
I've got a little bit of a background in it because my grandfather on my mother's side was in the steel business. He was president of a company called Manganese Steel out of Philadelphia, and then was president of a company called Taylor Wharton, which I believe now is part of Harsco, before he ultimately retired, I think in 1981 or 1982. And he went to Lehigh University. So when I was a kid out in that part of Pennsylvania, you know, obviously Bethlehem Steel was, come on, that was America at one point between the Bethlehem Works, and then you had Sparrow Point in Maryland and everywhere else. And steel business fell in some hard times, you know, in the 1980s and 1990s. And it really seems like it's reinvented itself in a lot of ways. And I think that if the direction, and you're going to shed a lot more light on this for certainly than I can, but if the direction the steel industry is taking is any way representative of what's happening in our economy, I think the U.S. is in a really great place right now. So what are your thoughts?
Well, you're gaslighting me with this idea, but you know, Brent, if you look at, I like to talk about LaGuardia Airport.
Yeah.
Okay. I know you spent a lot of time living in New York City.
Yes. And LaGuardia's.
So up until recently, right, you pull in the LaGuardia and think, I'm in a third world country.
Yes.
What is happening to me?
Yeah.
And I'm in Haiti. I'm not in New York. And, you know, why was LaGuardia the stage it was before they started to revamp it the last few years, right? It was the first airport,
exactly.
Right? I mean, it was the first substantial metropolitan, you know, urban airport that was relevant probably in the world.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at Dubai, they got brand new airports, right? They're building another brand new airport because 30 years ago in Dubai, it was a fishing village.
Yep.
Okay. So look at the steel industry in the United States. We've just finished a 44-year restructuring. That's what's happened. And it's over now. So you go back to pre-World War II, World War II, we come out of World War II, and the United States economy was 50% of the global economy. And our steel companies were the strongest steel companies in the world. Germany, obviously, Europe destroyed, Japan's destroyed. So we export our technology to those countries. They rebuild their steel industry and we live off the fat of the land. And in the 50s, there was a massive strike in the United States in steel business. It's the first time that imported steel had come into this country since the latter part of the 19th century, or 1800s, yeah, 19th century. So we let the foreign steel in the 50s and starts to germinate here. And then we stopped really inventing new technologies for steelmaking in the United States. We lived off what we had. We incrementally improved, but we really didn't move along with the rest of the world. But we were so rich for so long in the steel industry, right, that it took a while to erode that base from underneath. And you get to the late 1970s and you hit the first round of major restructuring in the United States steel industry, which happened in the early 80s and the mills were closed in Pittsburgh. Keep moving through the 80s and new technologies are invented by companies in the United States, namely Nucor Steel. Now, Nucor Steel invents, or doesn't invent, but deploys the first thin slab caster to make flat roll steel in the world. This is electric arc furnace manufacturing, or recycling scrap to make steel, to make it into sheet steel, which is the primary product used in developed economies. And Nucor sets about this massive technological change that happens in the 90s in the U.S. steel industry. So first you had antiquated old integrated steel mills. Then you had the advent of something called electric arc furnace or mini mill manufacturing, which was brand new technology in the United States. And that then takes another big swipe at the industry. And then it goes through consolidations and more restructurings in the 2000s and 2010s. And then suddenly, right around where COVID's hitting, U.S. Steel buys an electric arc furnace manufacturer called Big River Steel, which was a startup in 2016. Totally changes their business model.
Cleveland, U.S. Steel we're talking about, like US kind of the Steel, old dinosaur of the business.
The old dinosaur bought the brand new upstart renegade steel maker. And then Cleveland Cliffs, which is an old miner, which mines iron ore, they bought a massive steel company, which was a conglomerate, you know, kind of a agglomeration of old integrated steel making assets in the United States. They put together something called ArcelorMittal and AK Steel. Mm-hmm. And now you went from an industry when I started in it in the late 90s that had 25 flat roll steel manufacturers. Now you have six, four of which dominate the market. Mm-hmm. So you have new technology now in the United States, some of the best steel making in the world. We are as efficient or more efficient than anyone in the world to make steel in this country. We make the greenest, most carbon friendly, if you will, steel. Most of our steel is recycled. It's not virgin product.
It's like 70%.
It's 70% headed to over 80% in the next couple of years.
Okay.
And, you know, we have a very sustainable business model for steel now in the United States. So we just went through this massive restructuring and there are a lot of, you know, negative connotations about the steel business. In fact, I live out here with you in Arizona and there's not a lot of steel, you know, business out here. And when I meet friends and parents at school and things, they ask me what I do. I say, I'm in the steel industry. They say, well, do we still make steel in this country? I'm like, yeah, you know, we have the most efficient, you know, world-class steel business. You know, it's here in the United States. And what's incredible about what's happening is the reinvestment that's going on in infrastructure for steelmaking in the United States. So you have a tremendous amount of, I can't add up the billions of dollars that are being invested by companies like Nucor Steel and Steel Dynamics, Cleveland Cliffs and U.S. Steel in their businesses to develop new facilities, but it's many, 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 many billions of dollars. These are very healthy companies now, and we still have that stigma. And certainly when we're recruiting in our industry, or when we think about our industry, it's in this constant state of decline mentally, but it's really not. It's really super healthy and it's in a growth mode.
You know, when you talk about production, real quick question for you, the dominant player in the world is China. It's like 50% of global steel, something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And I was looking at that and kind of prepping for today. I was looking at where the U.S. stood in terms of global production through the last several decades. And there was a time in the 1980s where the Soviet Union made way more steel than we did. And of course, you know, when the wall fell, it fell off a cliff and I guess not much left of that. But is the stuff that China is making, from a quality standpoint, are they just churning out kind of the cheapest stuff, or are they making good stuff, or is there a quality difference between their steel and our steel?
They make some of the best steel in the world.
Okay.
The Chinese, you know, a ton of steel is not a ton of steel. And I don't want to get into too much detail. We don't have that kind of time and I don't want to be granular, but when you look at an economy that's developing, the preponderance of the steel that they produce in those countries are for heavy construction products, road building, building dams, you know, these kinds of heavy infrastructure. As an economy begins to mature, that the demand for that as a percentage of all the steel that an economy needs goes down. And what goes up are white goods type of steel. So these are flat roll steels called sheet steel. And you know, the economic value of a refined sheet steel product versus the economic value of a rebar that goes into the road are two totally different things.
Yeah.
So when you look to the United States and very mature, and you look to Europe, you know, very mature economies, most of the consumption are the more exotic flat roll steels. Certainly China can make everything we make in the United States and more. But if you look at their entire steel industry, right, it's still oriented toward building out basic infrastructure as a percentage of its total. Now, I don't know the exact percentages off the top of my head, but they can make anything and everything. They're very good at making steel, and they have some of the most competent manufacturers in the world. All right. So there's not really a quality difference, but they have a difference on the input side, which is that they use a lot of low grade iron ore and what's called sinter feed and lower grade iron products that they have to burn a tremendous amount of carbon to produce virgin iron to put into manufacturing, as opposed to the United States, where, you know, 80%, 70 now going to 80% of our flat roll steel is made with recycled product. So they've got to go through a tremendous transition that we've already gone through here.
Right.
So we're decades ahead because they built the steel industry from not much 20 years ago. And we've been going through this constant evolution over, you know, the last 40 years.
Got it. Now, obviously, Russia, Ukraine, the war is on everyone's mind that's dealing with any kind of global commodities. You look at what's done to the grain markets, what's done to the oil markets. What has the impact been in your world? First, I should probably do a little backtrack here. Tell us exactly how you are in this business and what Flat Global Metals does, so the listeners can get an idea of the lens you're looking through.
So we have a unique company in the steel space in the United States. We are a hybrid. We are one third domestic distributor, one third international commodity or merchant trader, and one third hedge fund. So when we started the business in 2000, our angle, our competitive advantage was wrapped with combining the old world steel business and distribution with new financial products that had been developed for steel on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So we're the first distributor, at least in the United States, to build the hedging of steel into the physical distribution of steel. And so that's been our space. It's been our niche. We built that niche. It didn't exist before us. And it's really new in the steel industry at large. I mean, we've got a couple hundred year old industry, and the hedge for flat roll steel has only been liquid for about the last 5 years. So we were ahead of that discussion, but we're also now known as kind of the establishment for risk management. And certainly that's something that is important to the financial market.
Sure, absolutely.
And how companies manage risk. And that's where we're at the front of that discussion.
So manufactured companies are coming to you and saying, we need this product, this product, this product. And you are essentially helping set that supply chain up for them and hedging off some of the risk and price fluctuations.
That's correct.
Okay. So you're in the middle of really of all this stuff. So give me an idea of what the disruptions to your supply chain, or at least in steel, have been as a result of what's happening now in Russia and Ukraine.
Well, the tale of Russia and Ukraine for the steel industry and for some of the other base metals is much different than for agriculture. So let's separate the two there. I think if you look at Ukraine and Russia from a food production standpoint, you have an entirely different discussion. And that disruption is far worse now that we kind of got a damage assessment from this war to the world and in energy markets than in the base metals market. So what's happening, or at least I don't have direct confirmation of this, but our sense of what is happening is that Russia's steel is being sold around the world at massive discounts to the global export price. And countries are buying it because they're in desperate financial need anyway. So why would they, if they can get a deal, they'll take a deal.
Right.
And they'll go around the sanctions. So what started to look like a shortage was developing in the inputs for making steel and some steel products because of the war, turned out there's unintended consequences. There's a tremendous amount of pressure when you combine it with China being shut down. So that's another kind of quandary at the moment. You have this disruption in the Ukraine, and you also have China with lockdowns.
Right.
And so the Chinese steel producers have been producing much less. In fact, their production is down 10% year over year, and 10% of China's steel production is and they make over a billion tons a year. So if that were to continue, that 10% reduction is the equivalent of the entire United States steel industry. So it's a lot.
Yeah.
So their inventories are piling up in China. You have the Russians, I don't want to say dumping because it's kind of a broad term, but moving material around the sanctions around the world, still producing. They haven't stopped making the stuff. Russia hasn't been as impacted as we would like to believe that, that they have been by the sanctions, at least not in base metals.
It doesn't look, it's doesn't look like it either, even in terms of, you know, financially. When the war started, the ruble collapsed. The ruble's trading right now back to where it was pretty much when the invasion
began.
Well,
they're selling oil for $120 a barrel. Well, they're actually selling it at a discount, but at that, they're getting a lot of cover.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, it's unintended consequences. If you go back and look at the Trump tariffs in 2018, which were the last time the steel business was popular to talk about, there were unintended consequences from those tariffs. The first thing that happened was there was a run on steel and pricing went up, and then a bubble was created and the bubble popped. And on the other side of it was a year and a half of declining prices. So we're starting to feel this vibe that there are unintended consequences from these sanctions and that Russia's working its way around it, which would be to your point, you know, they're doing okay in spite of it.
And, yeah, I read a story recently that some mills in Italy, one was getting their base steel from a Ukrainian mill. And I guess they did what they did or improved it from there. And they've been completely shut down since the war started. Mm-hmm. Another one was owned, was basically, they know it's owned by a Russian oligarch, mm-hmm. and the steel's coming from Russia, and they're running at full capacity because 51% ownership is in Italy. So they get around and the trucks that are bringing in, the trains that are bringing in are all technically not Russian. So it's just always fascinating to me that, you know, markets always tend to find a way.
You have a steel mill in the United States that's owned by Russia, and it's operating just fine.
Yeah. Yeah. So there we go.
For a minute there, it looked like it would be a big problem, but it's been worked around. And Ukraine is not a big steel producer.
Yeah.
So the Ukraine's steel business is not world. It's not going to be a world influence there. I mean, the size of the whole Ukrainian economy is, you know, $130 billion. It's tiny.
Yeah, it's if the market value of everything traded in Ukraine was an S&P 500 stock, it wouldn't be in the S&P 500. We're talking maybe a mid cap stock, a single mid cap stock.
Right.
Okay. So what do you think in terms of, you mentioned the lockdowns in China? So that sounds like it's probably having maybe a bigger impact than anything happened in Russia, Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, that's the story right now. Is are the Chinese going to try to or be able to even stimulate their way out of this situation? I mean, they're in a corner, and I don't, you know, you can read about all this outside of our opinion, but what we're seeing on the ground is a tremendous amount of pressure in Southeast Asia on steel prices. And then that's trickling. It's moving, you know, putting pressure in Europe, you know, as goes China's steel industry, goes the world steel industry. You made the point earlier that they're 50% of the, you know, world production for steel. So there's a domino effect. And United States is traditionally, we have been, that since the beginning of my career, short steel in this country. Like, we've made less than we've consumed. So we're a net importer of steel. And so we're, you know, the dominoes, when they start to you know, fall, it ends up falling here in the United States. So if we have a high price here, then, you know, Asia is taking advantage of that. So our price is spiked with Russia, Ukraine. There's like a short squeeze. And then, you know, product has been coming in, at least marketed here, and is coming here, you know, kind of undercover of high prices in the United States and low prices in Asia.
Got it. So basically, from a supply chain standpoint, steel business,
there's plenty of steel, right?
Plenty of steel.
There's plenty of steel. The COVID supply chain shortage, at least when it comes to steel, is over.
Yeah.
Completely over.
That's good to hear, because I've spoken to some people in other businesses, and they're saying that they're kind of telling me the same thing. You know, supply chain, obviously, a huge topic of conversation right now. And they are seeing in their businesses that although it may not be perfect, it's improving, it's getting better.
Yeah. Lead times are fairly short for us. You know, it feels like the normal, it's starting to feel like the normal steel business again, to a great extent.
Yeah.
So that's positive. And the positive, you know, I think looking at the companies throughout the supply chain in steel, they're very healthy businesses now. I mean, our customers have healthy businesses. The steel mills in this country are extremely healthy businesses, and good decisions are being made. You know, fluctuations, short-term fluctuations in the price. I had a conversation with a Wall Street analyst this morning. We talked about this very thing, which is that, you know, short, it used to be when you looked at the steel stocks or you looked at them from an equity investment standpoint, the price was the governing determinant of these stocks' values. And I think we're seeing more of a macro rotation in and out of these stocks. We're also seeing so that the street is starting to give them a little more value than just what they can convert steel for. And that's because of a lot of things. I think it's because they've made a lot of, you know, tremendous investment in their own businesses. They have more durable businesses. They have more durable earnings than they've had in the last several decades. There is some recognition, I think, that the industry has consolidated and has a little bit more pricing power. And there's also, you know, a step change going on in economy, in commodities, where commodities are going to be more expensive than they've ever been. And that's, we're not likely to head right back to where commodities were priced 4 or 5 years ago.
And many of these companies, and you mentioned it at the beginning of our conversation here, in the 1990s, what was it? It was legacy costs. It was huge debt burdens. It was trying to pump product out of these mills that were just not modern anymore. Mm-hmm. And through the consolidation that's occurred, I'm guessing, not knowing the business that well, probably a lot of that stuff has been now washed out, so that they're working with a much cleaner slate than they have been in the past. Is that accurate?
Look at a company like U.S. Steel. I mean, I think they've paid off all their debt. Their debt was enormous.
That is a debt-free company, right?
I think their debt is gone or will be gone very shortly. Cleveland-Cliffs, I think their debt is gone or will be gone very shortly. U.S. Steel is being valued something like two times
earnings.
Yeah. And these companies, they aren't the... The discussion in our industry now is the premise for a lot of the analysts and their view on the steel industry in the United States, with the fact that we're adding quite a bit of new capacity in our country, is that that's going to crash the price. It's going to crash the value. These companies are going to be too much capacity. The predicate there is that these companies today will act like the companies did during a 45-year restructuring. And my contention is they won't. They don't have to. They can close the mills. They can moderate production in slow times because they have the cash, they have the balance sheet to do it.
Right.
So, you know, there will be an ebb and flow of foreign steel coming in and out of this country, or coming into this country and then not coming into this country. There will be an ebb and flow in what we call apparent demand. So you have apparent demand, which is kind of the load on the mills and how companies like mine are feeling their backlogs growing or shrinking. And then you have real demand, which is how the economy bumps along, you know, buying things. Mm-hmm. So right now, apparent demand in our industry is not very good. There's a hangover from COVID and really high prices, and all these things is still being shaken out. But the real demand is very good. Our customers' backlogs are very strong. And step one, you know, the Fed's going to raise, and all we have, and again, you guys have at Raymond James have a lot more firepower on the general economics discussion than we do. But first stop for the automotive manufacturers is catch up. Second stop is fill the lots back up. How many years is that going to take? You know, we look at these figures, you know, we are making millions of cars less per year than we need to. The age of the automobile fleet is at 12 and a half years oldest it's ever been, apparently. Some of that has to do with the cars are better, but some of that has to do with you can't replace them.
Yeah.
And you create this chicken and the egg situation here in the United States with housing, with auto, with DIY, and from a steel consumption standpoint, because that's what I'm qualified to talk about, it's like, I don't want to say it's like this unlimited source of demand, but the demand is tremendous for steel in this country right now. And 100 or 200 basis point move in the Fed funds rate isn't going to wreck that, because that demand will still be there. I mean, household formation was slowed dramatically after the Great Recession. And we just kind of started climbing out of that in the late teens, and then bang, we walk into COVID, and for a year and a half, everybody took a pause.
Yeah.
And so add it up, right? Now we're short 10 million homes. These figures, everybody's got a figure, but the figure's big. We're short cars, we're short homes, we're short, you know, we're rearranging the way distribution works in this country. This is not talked about a whole lot, but you look at a regional mall that's now empty because nobody goes to the mall. The mall comes to you. So what are they doing with the malls? Amazon buys the malls. They retrofit them in the warehouses. What's it take? Lots of steel, right? Mm-hmm. Last mile retail. So you're rebuilding the retail infrastructure in this country as tastes have changed. And also, you know, a lot of the millennials, you know, not enough talk about the massive millennial generation, and they're old enough now to buy houses. I look at my millennials in our company. They're making a lot of money. They're doing great. They want to buy a house. They're having kids.
You know, yeah, they want a yard,
they're a much larger, from a population numbers standpoint than Gen Xers.
And way bigger than boomers. Way bigger than Gen Xers, but bigger than boomers now too.
They're huge, and they're driving this thing. And I read stuff, and I read something that said, well, there's no housing shortage because look, obviously everybody has a place to sleep. I mean, this is ridiculous kind of things that are being written. We are in a weird psychology after 08, 09, and we haven't shaken it yet, which is that tomorrow the world is going to end. And it, from our standpoint in our business, it certainly doesn't feel that way. It certainly feels that there's a lot of optimism and a lot of growth and a lot of reinvestment. A lot of our companies are investing in new facilities. They're investing in new equipment. They're raising capital for the right reasons,
right?
to grow their product breadth, the capabilities, the efficiency to deal with what looks to be a permanent labor shortage. So that takes a tremendous amount of investment to reinvent your business based on, you know, automation as opposed to manual labor. I mean, we're shifting, and you know, the demographics are going to lead the discussion. And certainly when it comes to something like steel, it's not going to lead the discussion when you talk about Bitcoins and things. But when you look about steel and the guts of the economy and an infrastructure bill coming, well, it's been passed, but it's going to take time for that money to get into the steel consuming economy. But we're super bullish. I mean, we're building a new facility in Houston to add capacity to our business. We wouldn't be doing it if we didn't think there was a market for it.
Yeah. And you bring up a good point. We've talked about this in the past, that it does seem that the thinking out there is very binary. It's either 100% on, this is the greatest thing in the world, or it's the world is ending.
Right.
And the truth is always somewhere in the middle. Sometimes you're closer to one side than the other side. But I'm with you on that in the sense that you look across the landscape, and is there going to be bumps in the road? Of course there is. But tell me if I'm wrong with this, but we've had two huge disruptions in the last couple of years. We had obviously COVID, big one. And now you've got Russia, Ukraine sort of simmering there in the distance and that big unknown around that. What has that taught companies that make stuff in the United States? It has taught them, in my view, tell me if I'm wrong, but if you have a $50, $100, $200,000, $5 million machine, whatever it is you're making and selling, and now your ability to put this thing out there, put it out in the marketplace is dependent upon this piece that you get for $5 a piece over in Asia or $100, whatever it is. All of a sudden, the incentive to save 10% of your cost by pushing that stuff offshore, when you realize how fragile that supply chain can be, even though there's workarounds that are found, the impetus to bring all that home has to be unbelievable. Am I wrong there?
No, you're right down the line. This is the discussion that's happening, and it's about sustainability of your physical supply chain as well as what's going to cost you to do it. And when you look at private equity, probably the public markets, the questions that CFOs are fielding have to do a lot with how much control do you have over your supply chain? And we've seen companies, whole purchasing organizations wiped out in the last year and a half because this model that grew out of an infinite supply of everything for free from China is gone. It's not gone, but it's severely disrupted. And the risk that's in these far-flung supply chains is too great. And there's a recolonization happening in the United States of manufacturing ability as a result of this. And so there's a premium now on, yeah, you have a great product, but how do you make that product? And how can you prove to us as an investor that you could continue to make it in all, you know, all seasons, right? For this thing. So yes, yes, and yes. And not just controlling the production of it, but controlling its cost. So that those are two, you know, in sometimes separate discussions.
Yeah. Well, you bring up, that's another great segue into the next question I was going to ask you. Controlling cost, another big topic right now in terms of what you're seeing in inflation in different sectors of the economy. How has that impacted your part of the world? What are your customers feeling out there?
Well, you know, the price, we sell a commodity. So we don't have, inflation for what we sell isn't very apparent looking because the price of steel, for example, in depths of COVID was about $400 a ton. So this is April 2020. And a year later, it was $1,900 a ton. So it, you know, is that inflationary or is that, you know, what is that, right? That's not really inflation. That's a whole lot of other things happening. Now it's trickling back down to around $1,100 a ton.
Okay.
So there's a lot of volatility in what we do. For us, the inflation is more happening in packaging materials. It's happening with labor in that aspect. But as a percentage of, you know, it's going up as a percentage of the sale, but most of our sales, so like, you know, about 90% of our, 80% of our cost as a business is the actual steel itself. So then we're managing that other 20% as far as from a cost standpoint. So inflation inside of our business isn't too serious, especially if the value of the commodity goes up, then there's some cover there for us.
Got it. And are you finding that that your customers in the past, because I was looking at your website and things that you do in the hedging world, in the past, I guess they weren't able to really do that. The financial products didn't exist for a large manufacturer that needs a bunch of steel to hedge off that risk.
Right. Steel's an interesting commodity because it's the commodity that's not really a commodity. If you look at the grain business, you know, a bushel of corn is a bushel of corn. Look at aluminum, and a chunk of aluminum is a chunk of aluminum, and you could sit it somewhere and leave it there, and it's fungible with other aluminum. Steel coils don't work that way. Steel coils erode. You know, so, you know, everyone knows what rust is. So if you look at take a steel coil and you set it outside in the yard, and 2 years later you have a pile of dust. So steel is not, it trades like a commodity, but it's not truly fungible. And that difficulty made it very hard as commodity markets developed in this country in the last 175 years, very hard to commoditize it for the future with a traditional futures contract. Unlike, for example, copper or interest rates, you know, it's again, each coil that a steel mill produces is that steel mill's specific coil. So they're not even the same amongst producers, even if they're specified to be the same.
Okay.
So flat roll steel is the most widely used industrial material in the world. Why? Because it's got an infinite combination of thicknesses and widths and grades and gauges and coatings and all kinds of things that go into it so that manufacturers can custom make their own product. Every order we get for steel is a custom order for that particular customer. So we have in the last 3 years, we sold 600 different manufacturers, and they had 600 different specifications for what they wanted, and then sub-specifications underneath. And so what makes it fabulous is it's infinitely changeable, and what makes it really hard to commoditize is it's infinitely changeable. So developing a hedge for it took a long time, and it was very illiquid at first. So we didn't have a hedge for steel until 2009, came on the New York Mercantile Exchange. And then it took it 7 or 8 years to begin to trade with any volume. So if you look at our industry, it's a couple hundred year old industry in this country, and it's only had a liquid futures contract for about 6 years.
It's amazing.
It's new in the industry. It's new for a lot of companies and OEMs to start to deal and grapple with this. But in the United States, you know, as opposed to Europe, you look at the small business community or the mid-sized business community in the United States, right? It's either family owned or private equity has then taken out the families. The private equity business in the United States is much larger than you look at the companies in Europe. It's a lot of legacy. You know, they pass things on generationally. We don't do that. And as much we do it, but we don't do it to the extent they do it like in a country like Germany. So you've got a lot of pressure now in the middle tier, which is a massive consumer of steel. There's a lot of pressure on these companies to begin to deal with price risk and put these tools to work. Whereas kind of left to our own devices, we kind of go back to the old, you know, ways of doing things because it is really new in our industry to hedge.
So how does a client hedge that out? They come to you and they're making, you know, refrigerators or cars or whatever the product is, and they've got this specification. They want this kind of steel, content of, you know, coke versus iron. However they do it, you know, how, like you said, it's not a clear commodity. So how do they go about pricing that risk?
So every steel coil starts as something called a hot roll coil. So even the cars, the doors on your car, the skin of those doors starts as a hot roll coil. And that is what we trade in the futures market.
Okay.
So you kind of trade the base thing.
And there's a premium above that.
That's correct. And so then you kind of fix the premiums and the conversion costs to get to whatever you need. Yeah, but you're starting with this base thing called a hot roll coil.
You know, it's like doing like a crack of a barrel of oil almost, and then kind of getting the component parts.
It is and it isn't, because a hot roll coil, what's great about the steel business is there's so much opportunity to evaluate it. You know, oil, first you start with crude oil.
Yeah.
So you got a light sweet crude, or you got a heavier crude or whatever, right? So you got 2-3 kinds of crude oil, whatever you have. And then you crack those off to jet fuel and diesel and whatever you're doing. Steel, you take three, primarily three independently traded commodities And you take those three independently traded things, you put them in to make steel. So you have iron ore, scrap, and coal.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So they all trade independently. Look at the coal market, right? Thermal coal market right now, which is heating coal, right? Or energy coal for, you know, because look at Europe, right? They ran out of wind and they got shut down by, you know, or they're shutting out Russia. Now, okay, they need more power. What do? They burn coal. I mean, these guys, okay, they burn coal now, and that's your marginal BTU at the moment. Because there's such demand for thermal coal, it's driving something called metallurgical coal's price, which is what we use in the steel industry to burn iron ore,
coke, right?
To get the iron out of the iron.
Okay,
ore.
Yeah.
So that's the fuel, right? So the coal is the fuel, the ore is the basic thing, and then you mix in scrap. Every steel manufacturer mixes in some scrap into the mix now in the way that we make steel in the world. So those things trade independently, and then you trade steel, and then steel turns into like these cracked off things like you're talking about in oil, where you have galvanized or cold roll or more value added different kinds of steels. So it's interesting because it funnels in, makes a thing, and then it sprouts off into new things. So there are a lot of angles with it.
Got it. And so the inflation that we're seeing, like you said, it's packaging and some other things like that, but it's not so much impacting the core commodity, which is the base of all this stuff.
Well, I mean, there's a case to be made that we've made a step change in commodities because it's going to be, especially when you look at base metals or aluminum kind of business, copper business, smelting businesses, because of ESG.
Mm-hmm. Perfect segue, because so, I wanted to talk to you about that.
So we talk about that, and we talk about this localization of supply chains. So all the things that you and I have been talking about during this conversation, at the end of the day, they add up to a more expensive world,
right?
Because the ways that we used to do things in our industries, those ways are changing quickly, and the premium is going up to make your product. So you look at the price of steel in the 90s, and the average, the inflation adjusted average of steel today in the 90s was $477 a ton. On or about 2004, China really entered the world stage as the dominant player in the steel industry. There was a step change in the market. And in the 16 years between 2004 and COVID, steel averaged almost $700 a ton. So it dipped back sometimes to the prices you saw in the prior decade, but didn't stick there for very long. Mm. Then we had COVID. And what COVID do in so many industries, it accelerated a time frame that was already out there. We were already going to use Zoom.
Right.
It was just going to take 10 years. And then it took 3 months. So, you know, the same thing happened in the steel industry. And you can see the change happening super fast now and the premium on becoming a sustainable business. And it amounts to a tremendous amount of cost. Go back and look at China. We had a discussion earlier. I said, well, yeah, China can make great steel, but what supports that needs a lot of change because there's a lot of aged looking, very carbon intensive, you know, coal-based energy production that's driving the steel market in China. What's it going to cost them to retool 50% of the world's steel production? It's going to be a lot of money. So what do they need in China? They need a high steel price. So you need a high steel price over cost to generate enough profit to reinvest in your infrastructure to create, right? So you have a chicken and the egg. And what we're seeing is now you have a step change in the price of steel. And so our projected range for steel prices going out the next decade is now kind of the bottom about $850 and the top about $1,250. So go back and look in the 90s, it was $477 a ton. And now we're saying a minimum would be $850.
And you're talking inflation adjusted back in the 90s.
That's inflation adjusted.
Yeah, so these are real constant dollars.
Right. So, you know, how much of it is inflationary per se, how much of it is structural change to the way we do business? I mean, it's a combination of both.
Yeah. In terms of ESG, so the people listening, it's environmental, social, and governance. It's a big kind of a hot button issue. I've had several people that have asked me, they want to invest exclusively behind those principles. What I think of those, that type of thing. I have other people that it angers them that you have this kind of stakeholder, not shareholder capitalism, but you have this stakeholder capitalism where you have people that may not be involved in actually the creation of the product. Now we're getting a say in how these businesses are being governed. I would imagine in something like steel, which is a lot cleaner, I think, now than most people would recognize, but the idea of it is still this smokestacky, you know, old polluting type business. How extreme are those ESG pressures with the people you're working with?
Well, it's building. It at Flack Global Metals, we just, for example, started a carbon trading desk where we're trading the voluntary and involuntary markets both globally for carbon credits. And we're doing that to support, primarily to support our customers so that we can help them work toward neutrality. And, you know, we don't have, as we run our business, we're not having emotional this, that, and the other about all this and this movement, right? It is happening.
It just is what it is.
It is what it is. And it's a movement around the world in the developed economies. And so, I read a book a long time ago, and in the book, the protagonist of the book said, everything that contributes to the world's improvement and spinning faster is good, and everything that tries to stop it is bad. And, you know, I don't know if that's true or not, but the point of this is that this is a real thing. It's a real movement. It's you can debate how fast the earth is warming and all this, but it doesn't even matter, right? What matters is socially, this is where we're headed. The idea is out there. It's taking hold. It's taking root. People will fight it, but why fight it? Let's move toward it, because there's so much trend in it. And we're behind to some degree in the United States from where they are in Europe. You know, Europe's the leader in this, and in California here in the United States is the leader. But you have significant, what's not written about enough or discussed enough, what we're seeing, are the carbon capture projects which are being developed, which are truly good, which are truly pulling carbon out of the atmosphere or preventing it from being emitted. And that generating a profit opportunity for someone. I mean, think about that. Your profit opportunity is to generate these credits that get sold in the public market. But in doing that, you've developed a profitable business by creating either an alternative energy source and or pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. I mean, this is all like super positive stuff.
Yeah.
So it's going to have fits and starts. And certainly there's some heavy hands out there. I mean, you look at some of the investment funds being extremely heavy handed about this stuff. But they're also, when you look at ESG, you have three separate subjects there that all get wrapped into one. We're focused on the environmental impact. The social construct, the rest of it, you know, we're not in our company. You know, we're small, but the environmental side of it is where we're focused.
Got it. And do you think, is there any sense of concern that from your customers or the people you're working with that us trying to adhere to these ESG standards or incorporating them to a greater degree into our business models here, does that make us less competitive with a country like China that just doesn't, quite frankly, give a damn about any of that stuff? At least now they're not.
Well, I think they do care. And that the people in China clearly care, because they're destroying their environment and they know it. I mean, it's hotter there, it's dirtier there, their air is dirty. The CCP has been pretty clear that they're going to try to do what they can do. Now, they've got issues in the short run here that they have to deal with, but over the long haul, there's only one way for them to go, or they're going to destroy their environment to a point where, you know,
yeah,
I mean, it's kind of,
it's been a while since I've been over there, but man, I mean, your sinuses are inflamed the entire time and you're breathing and all that.
The writing's on the wall. I mean, they have to do basic things there that we did here 50, 60, 70 years ago. You know, against back to this has to happen for humanity. And I'm not evangelist for environmental causes, but it's happening in business. It's important for business. I mean, why be wasteful? Our whole business model is built on eliminating waste. That's why we started our company. We wanted to help eliminate waste in supply chains. And we didn't spend much time today talking about the way we do business and put together supply chains. But our supply chains are built around our customers' needs, not around our capabilities in production.
Let's touch on that a little bit. And then when we wrap it up, because I know you're getting out of town this weekend. I do want to spend, I want to kind of close it out talking about sort of this conflict of visions that we have now between, say, Western democracies and some of the more authoritarian states. I want to close with that. But for now, though, let's talk about these issues with supply chains in terms of how you work in that space.
Yeah. So we design supply chains around the destination and the need, as opposed to our particular footprint. So we've been an asset-light company since we started, meaning production asset-light. And then we've woven in, obviously, the financial risk management products to bring the waste out of the financial side of it. But we've been optimizing supply chain since we started the company, which means if it makes the most sense for it to go by rail first to somewhere to unload before it goes to the next place to, you know, we've been very efficient there. And that's how we'd be competitive. So getting waste out of supply chains was kind of a core value of FGM before it was popular to talk about. So it's natural for us, for example, to get into carbon, right? Because we've been in that, and it was natural for us to demonstrate to our industry that if you can save money by hedging over long durations of time, which we have all the studies and everything, we support that, then the money that you're seeding to the marketplace, there's your money to reinvest in your carbon footprint. There's the money to reinvest in your company to make it more efficient and have a lesser footprint.
Got it.
That's our approach.
Yeah. And again, having spent some time on your website, you guys are, it's really cool what you're doing in that space.
Thank you.
It's very cool. I want to close with this is I've got this, there's a couple of different points I'm going to come at here. This country, to me, it seems like we've just been beating ourselves up lately. And if you look, there's all this talk about decline. It's all this talk about negative things that are happening in the country. And the country's got its problems. Every society and every individual organization, there's something going on. But another thing that I think that the whole COVID and the Russia-Ukraine thing and everything else has kind of brought forth, it has really clarified and crystallized different visions that the world can kind of choose to live under right now. You've got Western democracies, flawed in their own ways for sure, but have been an absolute, we live in the world created by Western democracies. Versus, say, what you have in Russia or China specifically, these very authoritarian regimes that where the people are essentially just, they get thrown in the meat grinder and the regime is going to do whatever they want, versus the freedom and the in many cases, the liberalism we have in the West, but also the ability for people to actualize great ideas and do great things. And we've talked at length about this. And you talk about your own story and in terms of anything being possible in this country. And I just want, I'm going in circles here, but I want to expand on that.
You just gave me four topics.
So. Well, hit one of them because we don't take time to recognize, and I've said this before on this podcast, this country is an absolute miracle. It's an absolute miracle. And this notion that, first of all, the country has anything to apologize for, to me, it's complete nonsense. This notion that you cannot achieve things and that this country is not going to continue to advance in the future, to me, is also complete nonsense. So I want to just kind of send that over to you because I know you're almost an evangelist in terms of the future of this country.
Yeah, we're very bullish on the United States. And, somebody with, a few years ago, the popular thing to talk about, certainly in our industry, is, oh my God, look how many engineers are graduating in China. They're graduating 300,000, whatever the number was, engineers. And we're only graduating 30,000. They're 10 times more. Therefore, they're going to beat us out by 10 times. And I look at the kids in the United States, right? I have a 20-year-old son. I have a 17-year-old son. I have a 7-year-old daughter. And I look at the kids. And, the kids, they watch the TikTok videos and they're doing all this crazy stuff in the United States. And we look at our children, oh my God, these kids are lazy. I mean, that's what they said about us Gen Xers, that we were lazy, but then we invented the internet anyway, or the use of it. But you look at a child in the United States that says, I want to go into engineering. This is what I want to do with my life. And then they go into engineering and maybe they invent something. They get to keep that invention. You don't get to keep your invention in China.
Yep.
You don't get to keep anything in China. And so our kids here, maybe less of them end up going into these technical fields and maybe in some theoretical idea that these other countries have more volume of it, but do they have as creative a volume as we have? I have a friend and he's from London and he was in LA recently and he pointed out the homeless situation in LA, which is a travesty. He said, we don't have that in the UK. We just don't have that in the UK. And I said, well, name five things that were invented in the UK in the last 50 years that we use in our daily life. Yeah. And he looked at me, we're still innovating in this country and, things don't happen in a straight line. We are the world's reserve currency. That's not changing, no matter what the pundits are talking about. There's no substitute. There's nowhere else to go. You're not going to go to the euro. That can break up at any time. Certainly not going to the Chinese RMB. Look what they're doing right now.
Absolutely is blasting liquidity in their own system.
Blasting everything. Yeah. So where are you going to go? You're going to stay in the dollar, at least for now, at least for the next 100 years or some long, crazy long period of time. And we're certainly not going to supplant the dollar with Bitcoins. So, and that's another whole discussion, but I'm optimistic on the United States because people in the United States, like my brother, okay, my brother's a solar engineer, and he's invented the technology to dramatically reduce the amount of time that it takes to install a solar panel on a roof. And then he's created a technology that really any labor, any mechanical type of person can go on a roof and do it instead of having a specific set of training and everything to put these solar panels in. So he's really democratizing this process and economizing it. And he will keep his invention and he will grow that business. And this is, you know, so maybe our kids are a little more creative because they can bounce around, and maybe our kids are going to do just fine because I look at the children today and they're so much further along in understanding how the world works than I was when I was their age. And we're, you know, yes, the education system, there's problems everywhere. You can look for all the problems. You want to look for problems, you'll find problems. You want to nourish yourself with problems, you'll find problems. But there's so many green shoots in the United States from a technology standpoint, educational standpoint, invention standpoint. It's all here. And we're big enough and strong enough where, you know, the next chapter in our development as a country has not been written yet. And this country is a gift to the world.
I agree with you 100%. I agree with 100%. And I know you've been around, and you know, I've been to 56 countries now at this point. And yeah, when you see what your option is, there is no place else to be than what you can do in the United States. And you bring up a key point. You can have a great idea here. You can build a business and you do get to keep it, which is absolutely amazing. And you get to hopefully you're making everybody else's lives better in the process.
I mean, democracy is messy.
Yeah.
But you're seeing democracy in this country. You know, they say it's dead, or Trump broke it, or Biden broke it, and it's craziness. I don't talk about that. But look at them in China right now. They made a policy and they said, we're going to have zero COVID. That's it. This is what we're doing. In spite of the thing developing and changing, and in spite of what viruses do, we're the Chinese Communist Party. And we said, we're going to get rid of COVID by locking them up and whatever. And it can't stop because that's the premium is on that. There was a great show. I don't know how much time we have left. There was a great show on HBO about Chernobyl.
Right.
And in Chernobyl, this reenactment of what happened there, you get the boss man is sitting in the office and the worker comes in and he says to the boss man, the reactor melted down. It's gone. He says, no, it's not. It's not gone. He says, no, it's just out there. This is a big problem. The thing is gone. It's sunk into the earth. And he says, you're going to lose your job. I'm going to fire you from your job. If you say that again, go out there and fix it. Okay. So like, this is what's happening right now. And this is you see China and they're very smart. Okay. This is a sophisticated people. They're not, but they're caught in a trap. Everything has gone their way for the last 30 years with us supporting it.
Yes.
So we have supported them with technology. They have stolen our technology, whatever we've done to transfer technology to them. And we've benefited from it. Okay. I'm not going to say we haven't. We've benefited from it tremendously in this country. I mean, everything they sold us, they took a loan back with US Treasuries. It was fabulous for us. It's a big investment China made in the United States. But they haven't had to make any tough decisions. They just followed along and become extremely powerful, and they've done extremely well. But you look at their central bank, what is it? Well, it's modeled off of ours, right?
Right.
But you look at our central banks had to make decisions for 100 years. Theirs has had to make decisions for the last decade, really.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have the depth of institutions that we have. They just don't. And I'm not like down on China, but they're having a real problem with this COVID thing. This is the first problem they can't squish with force.
And there's no flexibility in those institutions.
Right. So the United States, like if you don't do a good job, or if we don't think you did a good job, you're out of office. You're boom, out you go. That's not what's happening there. There's one party rule. So, you know, it's sloppy here. It doesn't look as clean. And they were using that from a propaganda standpoint, certainly said, well, look at the United States, look at a mess. I mean, this Trump thing and their election, and there was a thing in the January 6th, and oh my God, these people are a mess and they can't handle COVID. Everybody's dying. And now look at them,
right?
They can't make a decision and they can't get their way out of it. And so this, like, to me, lends to, sure, they're going to make good AI and 5Gs or whatever. Okay. My phone still works here. I don't know if I have 5G or not. It says 5G. I don't think it really is 5G, but it doesn't really matter. I can still make a phone call. It's not the issue. The issue is How are they going to innovate when they are willing to lock you up and put wire, steel wire on your door so you can't escape your house when they decide? And then they send drones flying around Shanghai saying, resist the temptation for freedom.
Yeah.
So these people are going to lead the world? I don't think so.
I 100% agree.
I think we'll continue to lead the world. We have a messy process. It's been messy since we started. You know, we talk about, well, this, that, and the other with Twitter, and this, that, and the other is a horrible thing. And we say horrible things about each other in social media. Back in the founding fathers days, if I didn't like you, I started a newspaper. Okay. I'm Thomas Jefferson. I start a newspaper
or we'd have a duel
about someone and say, well, and make up horrible things about that person and publish it. And there were like, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of these newspapers circulating in DC and in New York and in Philly back, you know, and it was all made up. Okay. We've been doing this.
Yeah.
And that anybody thinks this is novel, what's going on with our discourse here in the United States, it's not.
Yeah.
Okay. It's the same thing. It's messy here, but maybe that mess and maybe the fact that our kids, you know, live kind of a random lifestyle as opposed to, you know, kids that are only taught STEM in Asia, maybe it yields a better way.
Well, and we'll leave it on that. But Jeremy, I got to tell you, I've been really excited. Eric's told me or heard me talk about you for a little while now, wanting to get you on here. And cannot thank you enough for carving some time out of your afternoon to have this discussion. This was awesome. And thanks again for coming in.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Brent. It's a pleasure knowing you. And you're very thoughtful about what you do. And I know you personally, and you're thoughtful about what you're doing at work for your investors. And you know, these kinds of things are great to do because, you know, we all are on automatic pilot all the time, and to take a moment out of it and really look at the world, step apart from it is a welcome thing to do. So appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely.
Well, I just love the positivity, period. What a way to end a podcast. I just think that it's something that we don't have enough of, the positivity that we all need to be listening to. So both of you, thank you so much for the podcast. Brent, of course, thank you so much for facilitating this. And our last thank you goes to the listening audience. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to the Smart Money Simplified Podcast with Brent Mikosh. If you have not subscribed to the podcast yet, please click the subscribe now button below. This way, when Brent comes out with a new podcast, it'll show up directly on your listening device. This makes it really easy to share these podcasts with your friends and family. And again, this is a very positive one. Let's share this one. Again, thanks for listening today. For everyone at MP Advisors, this is Eric Johnson reminding you to live your best day every day. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Smart Money Simplified Podcast. Have any questions about topics covered during the show? Visit www.smartmoneysimplified.com or give us a call at 602-255-0555. Don't forget to click the follow button below to be notified when new episodes become available. The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the hosts and or guests and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Raymond James Financial Services Incorporated. The content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional financial advice. Always seek the advice of your financial advisor or other qualified financial service providers with any questions you may have regarding your individual situation. Securities are offered through Raymond James Financial Services Incorporated, member FINRA, and SIPC. Investment advisory services offered through Raymond James Financial Services Advisors Incorporated, MP Advisors, LLC, is not a broker/dealer and is independent of Raymond James Financial Services.